Chapter 9. What kind of thing? The panels. He glanced at her indulgently. His self-confidence was too impenetrable to feel the pinprick of such a doubt. Immensely sure, he said with a smile. And you don't mind taking so much money from her in advance? He stared. Why should I? She'll get it back with interest. He laughed and drew at his pipe. It will be an uncommonly interesting experience. I shouldn't wonder if it freshened me up a bit. She looked at him again. The second hint of self-distrust struck her as the sign of a quickened sensibility. What if, after all, he was beginning to be dissatisfied with his work? The thought filled her with a renovating sense of his sufficiency. 3. They stopped in London to see the National Gallery. It was thus that, in their inexperience, they had narrowly put it, but in reality every stone of the streets, every trick of the atmosphere, had its message of surprise for their virgin sensibilities. The pictures were simply the summing up, the final interpretation, of the cumulative pressure of an unimagined world, and it seemed to Claudia that long before they reached the doors of the galleries he had some intuitive revelation of what awaited them within. They moved about from room to room without exchanging a word. The vast noiseless spaces seemed full of sound, like the roar of a distant multitude heard only by the inner ear. Had their speech been articulate, their language would have been incomprehensible, and even that far-off murmur of meaning pressed intolerably on Claudia's nerves. Keniston took the onset without outward sign of disturbance. Now and then he paused before a canvas, or prolonged from one of the benches his silent communion with some miracle of line or color, but he neither looked at his wife, nor spoke to her. He seemed to have forgotten her presence. Claudia was conscious of keeping a furtive watch on him, but the sum total of her impressions was negative. She remembered thinking when she first met him that his face was rather expressionless, and he had the habit of self-engrossed silences. All that evening, at the hotel, they talked about London, and he surprised her by an acuteness of observation that he had sometimes inwardly accused him of lacking. He seemed to have seen everything, to have examined, felt, compared, with nerves as finely adjusted as her own, but he said nothing of the pictures. The next day they returned to the National Gallery, and he began to study the paintings in detail, pointing out differences of technique, analyzing and criticizing, but still without summing up his conclusions. He seemed to have a sort of provincial dread of showing himself too much impressed. Claudia's own sensations were too complex, too overwhelming, to be readily classified. Lacking the craftsman's instinct to steady her, she felt herself carried off her feet by the rush of incoherent impressions. One point she consciously avoided, and that was the comparison of her husband's work with what they were daily seeing. Art, she inwardly argued, was too various, too complex, dependent on too many interrelations of feeling and environment, to allow of its being judged by any provisional standard. Even the subtleties of technique must be modified by the artist's changing purpose, as this in turn is acted on by influences, of which he is himself unconscious. How, then, was an unprepared imagination to distinguish between such varied reflections of the elusive vision? She took refuge in a passionate exaggeration of her own ignorance and insufficiency. After a week in London they went to Paris. The exhibition of Keniston's pictures had been opened a few days earlier, and as they drove through the streets on the way to the station an impressionist poster here and there invited them to the display of the American artist's work. Mrs. Davant, who had been in Paris for the opening, had already written rapturously of the impression produced, enclosing commendatory notices from one or two papers. She reported that there had been a great crowd on the first day, and that the critics had been immensely struck. The Kenistons arrived in the evening, and the next morning Claudia, as a matter of course, asked her husband at what time he meant to go and see the pictures. He looked up absently from his guidebook. What pictures? Why yours, she said, surprised. Oh, they'll keep, he answered, adding with a slightly embarrassed laugh, we'll give the other chaps a show first. Presently he laid down his book and proposed that they should go to the Louvre. They spent the morning there, lunched at a restaurant nearby, and returned to the gallery in the afternoon. Keniston had passed from inarticulateness to an eager volubility. It was clear that he was beginning to coordinate his impressions, to find his way about in a corner of the great imaginative universe. He seemed extraordinarily ready to impart his discoveries, and Claudia felt that her ignorance served him as a convenient buffer against the terrific impact of new sensations. On the way home, she asked when he meant to see Mrs. Davant. His answer surprised her. Does she know we're here? Not unless you've sent her word, said Claudia, with a touch of harmless irony. That's all right, then, he returned simply. I want to wait and look about a day or two longer. She'd want us to go sightseeing with her, and I'd rather get my impressions alone. The next 2 days were hampered by the necessity of eluding Mrs. Davant. Claudia, under different circumstances, would have scrupled to share in this somewhat shabby conspiracy, but she found herself in a state of suspended judgment, wherein her husband's treatment of Mrs. Davant became for the moment merely a clue to larger meanings. They had been 4 days in Paris when Claudia, returning one afternoon from a parenthetical excursion to the Rue de la Paix, was confronted on her threshold by the reproachful figure of their benefactress. It was not to her, however, that Mrs. Davant's reproaches were addressed. Keniston, it appeared, had borne the brunt of them, for he stood leaning against the mantelpiece of their modest salon in that attitude of convicted negligence when, if ever, a man is glad to take refuge behind his wife. Claudia had, however, no immediate intention of affording him such shelter. She wanted to observe and wait. He's too impossible, cried Mrs. Davant, sweeping her at once into the central current of her grievance. Claudia looked from one to the other. For not going to see you? For not going to see his pictures, cried the other nobly. Claudia colored and Keniston shifted his position uneasily. I can't make her understand, he said, turning to his wife. I don't care about myself, Mrs. Davant interjected. I do, then. It's the only thing I do care about, he hurriedly protested. I meant to go at once. To right, Claudia wanted to go, but I wouldn't let her. He looked helplessly about the pleasant red-curtained room, which was rapidly burning itself into Claudia's consciousness as a visible extension of Mrs. Davant's claims. I can't explain, he broke off. Mrs. Davant in turn addressed herself to Claudia. People think it's so odd, she complained. As so many of the artists here are anxious to meet him. They've all been so charming about the pictures, and several of our American friends have come over from London expressly for the exhibition. I told everyone that he would be here for the opening. There was a private view, you know, and they were so disappointed they wanted to give him an ovation, and I didn't know what to say. What am I to say? She abruptly ended. There's nothing to say, said Keniston slowly. But the exhibition closes the day after tomorrow. Well, I shan't close, I shall be here, he declared with an effort at playfulness. If they want to see me, all these people you're kind enough to mention, won't there be other chances? But I wanted them to see you among your pictures, to hear you talk about them, explain them in that wonderful way. I wanted you to interpret each other, as Professor Wildmarsh says. Oh, hang Professor Wildmarsh, said Keniston, softening the combination with a smile. If my pictures are good for anything, they oughtn't to need explaining. Mrs. Davant stared. But I thought that was what made them so interesting, she exclaimed. Keniston looked down. Perhaps it was, he murmured. There was an awkward silence, which Claudia broke by saying, with a glance at her husband, but if the exhibition is to remain open tomorrow, could we not meet you there? And perhaps you could send word to some of our friends. Mrs. David brightened like a child whose broken toy is glued together. Oh, do make him, she implored. I'll ask them to come in the afternoon. We'll make it into a little tea. 5 o'clock. I'll send word at once to everybody. She gathered up her beruffled boa and sunshade, settling her plumage like a reassured bird. It will be too lovely, she ended in a self-consoling murmur. But in the doorway a new doubt assailed her. Why you won't fail me? She said, turning plaintively to Keniston. Why you'll make him come, Mrs. Keniston? I'll bring him, Claudia promised. When, the next morning, she appeared equipped for their customary ramble, her husband surprised her by announcing that he meant to stay at home. The fact is I'm rather surfeited, he said, smiling. I suppose my appetite isn't equal to such a plethora. I think I'll write some letters and join you somewhere later. She detected the wish to be alone, and responded to it with her usual readiness. I shall sink to my proper level, and buy a bonnet then, she said. I haven't had time to take the edge off that appetite. They agreed to meet at the Hotel Cluny at midday, and she set out alone with a vague sense of relief. Neither she nor Keniston had made any direct reference to Mrs. Davant's visit. But its effect was implicit in their eagerness to avoid each other. Claudia accomplished some shopping in the spirit of perfunctoriness that robs even new bonnets of their bloom, and this business dispatched, she turned aimlessly into the wide inviting brightness of the streets. Never had she felt more isolated amid that ordered beauty which gives a social quality to the very stones and mortar of Paris. All about her were evidences of an artistic sensibility pervading every form of life, like the nervous structure of the huge frame, a sensibility so delicate, alert and universal, that it seemed to leave no room for obtuseness or error. In such a medium the faculty of plastic expression must develop as unconsciously as any organ in its normal surroundings. To be artistic must cease to be an attitude and become a natural function. To Claudia, the significance of the whole vast revelation was centered in the light it shed on one tiny spot of consciousness, the value of her husband's work. There are moments when to the groping soul the world's accumulated experiences are but stepping stones across a private difficulty. She stood hesitating on a street corner. It was barely 11, and as he had an hour to spare before going to the Hotel Cluny. She seemed to be letting her inclination float as it would on the cross currents of suggestion emanating from the brilliant, complex scene before her, but suddenly, in obedience to an impulse that she became aware of only in acting on it, she called a cab and drove to the gallery where her husband's pictures were exhibited. A magnificent official in gold braid sold her a ticket and pointed the way up the empty crimson carpeted stairs. His duplicate, on the upper landing, held out a catalogue with an air of recognizing the futility of the offer, and a moment later she found herself in the long, noiseless, impressive room full of velvet-covered ottomans and exotic plants. It was clear that the public ardor on which Mrs. Davant had expatiated had spent itself earlier in the week, for Claudia had this luxurious apartment to herself. Something about its air of rich privacy, its diffusion of that sympathetic quality in other countries so conspicuously absent from the public showroom, seemed to emphasize its present emptiness. It was as though the flowers, the carpet, the lounges, surrounded their visitor's solitary advance with the mute assurance that they had done all they could toward making the thing go off, and that if they had failed it was simply for lack of cooperation. She stood still and looked about her. The pictures struck her instantly as odd gaps in the general harmony. It was self-evident that they had not cooperated. They had not been pushing, aggressive, discordant. They had merely effaced themselves. She swept a startled eye from one familiar painting to another. The canvases were all there and the frames, but the miracle, the mirage of life and meaning, had vanished like some atmospheric illusion. What was it that had happened? And had it happened to her, or to the pictures? She tried to rally her frightened thoughts, to push or coax them into a semblance of resistance. But argument was swept off its feet by the huge rush of a single conviction, the conviction that the pictures were bad. There was no standing up against that. She felt herself submerged. The stealthy fear that had been following her all these days had her by the throat now. The great vision of beauty through which she had been moving as one enchanted was turned to a phantasmagoria of evil mocking shapes. She hated the past. She hated its splendor, its power, its wicked magical vitality. She dropped into a seat, and continued to stare at the wall before her. Gradually, as she stared, there stole out to her from the dim tumbled canvases a reminder of what she had once seen in them, a spectral appeal to her faith, to call them back to life. What proof had she that her present estimate of them was less subjective than the other? The confused impressions of the last few days were hardly to be pleaded as a valid theory of art. How, after all, did she know that the pictures were bad? On what suddenly acquired technical standard had she thus decided the case against them? It seemed as though it were a standard outside of herself, as though some unheeded inner sense were gradually making her aware of the presence, in that empty room, of a critical intelligence that was giving out a subtle effluence of disapproval. The fancy was so vivid that, to shake it off, she rose and began to move about again. In the middle of the room, stood a monumental divan surmounted by a massif of palms and azaleas. As Claudia's muffled wanderings carried her around the angle of the seat, she saw that its farther side was occupied by the figure of a man, who sat with his hands resting on his stick, and his head bowed upon them. She gave a little cry and her husband rose and faced her. Instantly the live point of consciousness was shifted, and she became aware that the quality of the pictures no longer mattered. It was what he thought of them that counted. Her life hung on that. They looked at each other a moment in silence. Such concussions are not apt to flash into immediate speech. At length he said simply, "I didn't know you were coming here." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.